Genesis 1:1-2:3, The Foundations of the World. The 12th talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits was presented by David Crabtree on January 13, 1998, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I'm talking about Genesis chapter 1, and my intention is to go through some stuff rather quickly, and I will be going, I won't be spending a lot of time in the passage itself. I think that it's necessary for me to explain why I am taking the approach that I am taking to the chapter and justify that. So I'll be spending most of my time doing that. Then I'm going to just briefly go through the passage and explain what I think the passage is doing, and then open it up for questions, and we can talk about specific features of the chapter, whatever you'd like to talk about, and I will feel free to say I don't know at any point that that's necessary, which will be most of them. Genesis chapter 1 is a very difficult chapter, I think. For some reason, I find a lot of passages in the Bible difficult, but this is one of them. And part of the thing that makes it difficult is the first time we read it, our inclination is to think God must have intended this to be here to refute evolution. And to read it as an account of how it really happened, how God did it, so that we have ammunition to use against the Darwinists and the Neo-Darwinists and the Pseudo-Darwinists and all the other varieties. But and if that's what Moses, when he wrote it, intended, then that's the way we should understand it. But I think that there is reason to question whether that's what Moses intended to do when he wrote chapter 1 of Genesis. And so that's what I want to look at, is what, how does Genesis 1 fit in with Genesis? What should we expect from it? And then look at it accordingly. Let me start by reading it, just to familiarize, remind us of what's there, and then I'll begin my argument. Genesis chapter 1, starting with verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, one day. Then God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse, and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening, and there was morning, a second day. Then God said, "Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit after their kind with seed in them on the earth." And it was so. And the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, a third day. Then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs, and for seasons, and for days and years. And let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, and the lesser light to govern the night. He made the stars also. And God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, and to govern the day and the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, a fourth day. Then God said, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens. And God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening, and there was morning, a fifth day. Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind, and it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created them, male and female he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth, and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Then God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed, it shall be for food for you. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth, which has life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw that all he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, and all their hosts. And by the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. I think it is difficult to just start in Genesis chapter 1 and figure out what God is trying to do, what Moses is trying to do with this particular chapter. What is his purpose for including this information in the book of Genesis? It seems to me that what one has to do is read the entire book of Genesis and then see how it fits in to what is there. I liken it to a situation in which, let's say we were playing a word game, and I told you that it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, a seven-letter word, and I want you to tell me what the first letter is. How many choices do you have? How many good, viable choices do you have? Approximately, what, 24, 25, 26, something like that. It's really up in the air. There are a lot of options. But if we know what all of the other letters are, and I won't make them up on the spot because I'll misspell something, but if we knew what the other letters were, then how many options would you have? I don't know, but it would be less than 24. And if we can do the same thing with Genesis, if we can think about the book as a whole, and think about what's going on in Genesis, then it narrows down what Genesis 1 is doing. It limits our options. Now, that's the approach I want to take, and we'll talk about that just a little bit. But in likening Genesis to this word, I'm making an assumption. It's a very important assumption. And that is that there is a relationship between these different parts. Just as there is a relationship between the sounds and a word. I'm assuming that in Genesis, Moses is making an argument. He's presenting a case. It's a coherent whole. If it's not a coherent whole, then this analogy does not hold. It doesn't work. If Moses is just going through, I've got a thought here. And then chapter 2 is, hey, I've got another thought here. And chapter 3, I've got another thought here. Then this analogy does not work. It only works if Moses has a line of thought that's going through, and we can determine what the end of that line of thought is, then that helps us figure out what the beginning of it is. I bring that up because it is my experience growing up as a Christian that this assumption was not made. More times than not, this assumption was not made, that the book is a coherent whole. And therefore, it helps us to know what comes before it and what comes after it in order to figure out what's going on right here in this particular passage. Okay, so what's going on in Genesis, just in broad terms? After the creation account, we have about 5 or 6 chapters that talk about man in general. For the most part, it is the wickedness of man. What we see right after the creation account is man's fall in the Eve. Man's fall in the garden. Then we have the killing of Abel by Cain. Then we have the Tower of Babel. Isn't the Tower of Babel? No, Noah. Noah's the next thing. And God's destruction of all mankind. Then after the story of the flood, we pick up with the story of Abraham. So we focus in on one individual, Abraham, and God's dealings with that particular individual. And the way that God comes into his life and blesses him. God chooses to single out this person, and out of the blue he says, I'm going to bless you. And that's what he proceeds to do. And by doing that, by blessing him, he changes Abraham's life. Then we follow the descendants of Abraham. Abraham's son Isaac, then Abraham's son Jacob, and Jacob's children. So the last part of Genesis is devoted to following this one line, and again, this same process by which God comes in and blesses an individual and goes through a process of transforming that individual, making him a different kind of person, a more righteous person. So the emphasis in Genesis is not on anything else in creation except for man and man's relationship to God. It's not about geology. It's not about what are the other things? Biology. It is focused on one of God's creations, and that is man, and the relationship between man and God. So how could a story about the beginning of creation, how could that help us to understand what Genesis goes on to talk about in developing an understanding of who man is? Last quarter in the courses in Gutenberg, we read 3 authors who wrote about a theory of government: Hobbes, Locke, and Rousseau. And all 3 of them, in trying to explain what government ought to be, ended up reconstructing how government came into existence. None of them cited any historical facts. For each one of them, it was a thought experiment. What must have been the case? What must have happened? Why would they all go back to where government came from? They're trying to figure out how government came to be, in order to answer the more important question, the question they're really trying to get at, and that is, why did government come to be? What is its purpose? Why does government exist? If we know why something came into existence, then that helps us to understand its purpose, what it's supposed to do. So it makes the most sense to me. I think what's happening in Genesis is chapter 1 is helping to explain to us why man came to be. What is his purpose for existence? Okay, let's look a little bit at the organization. Let me answer a couple of questions about ways that we could look at this. First of all, I think it's important to note that Genesis 1 is a very stylized account. If you read on in Genesis, none of the rest of Genesis sounds the same as Genesis chapter 1. What is it that's different about Genesis chapter 1? Genesis chapter 1, well, the thing that stands out right away is it's formulaic, it's repetitive. It says, every day begins with, then God said, blank. Then it goes on and talks about it. Then God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning one day. And then we go on to the next day. It's very structured, repetitive. What we have is proceeding through day one, day two, day three, day four, day five. It could be that it's organized according to chronology. It could be that what Moses is doing here is explaining, this is what happened first, this is what happened second, this is what happened third, this is what happened fourth, etc. However, that's not necessarily the thread of organization here. It doesn't look exactly like historical narrative that we run into later. It looks like something else. And it could be that we don't have chronology as the organizing factor. Even if it were historical narrative, chronology is not necessarily the organizing factor. My advisor, when I was in studying history at the university, I remember a lecture that he gave on some reforms that took place in Russia in the 1860s called the Great Reforms. And he wanted to explain what all of the different changes that were instituted, all of the separate reforms that were instituted during this period of great reforms. And he did not go through chronologically and present what reform was done first and which one was done second and which one was done third. Because there was a logic to all of the reforms, and it made more sense to present them in a way in which one reform built on another, which built on another logically. And the point that he wanted to make was that all of the reforms were done in order to strengthen the military. So in his presentation, he had it all building up to the reforms that were made in the military. So if you looked at his outline, he talked about a reform that was done in 1858 first, and then one done in 1863, and then one done in 1860, etc., etc. It was not in chronological order, because that was not the most coherent way to present that material, because there was an inner logic to it that dictated a different kind of order. I think that that's a possibility here. There are a number of people who have pointed out that there are some anomalies in the way that this is presented. And these are the kinds of things that they point out. That we have, in day one, we have light created before we have bodies, luminous bodies that are created in day four. We have plants being created in day three, but we don't have any light for the plants to live until day four. Day three, plants. Day four, light. Luminous bodies. We do have light created in day one. And I can't remember, there are some others that are pointed out. And then you have people who want to defend this as being chronological, who will refute each of those concerns that are raised. I'm not interested in going through either the anomalies or the refutations. My concern, rather, is that I want to raise the possibility that chronology is not the operating form of organization here. And in fact, if you look at it, there seems to be a different organization here. Okay, so I don't think we have, or we don't necessarily have, a chronological presentation here. It seems to be poetic, it seems to be a genre other than historical narrative. There's no reason to necessarily assume that it is a chronological organization. And we can look for the possibility that there be some other form of organization. Now, at the very beginning, it says, at the very first verse, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Now, I will not go into great detail on this, but it has been argued, and I think quite plausibly, that at least the first several chapters, the first, can't remember what it turns out to be, like the first 15 chapters of Genesis, was compiled from sources. That Moses was compiling this account from other written sources that he had in hand. And the reason that that is argued is because there is a statement that appears at intervals throughout those chapters where it says, these are the generations of. The first one appears in, let's see, 5, I think. Chapter 5, verse 1, this is the book of the generations of Adam. And it is my understanding, I take this all on the authority of other people because I haven't looked at it myself at all, but many of the ancient records were written on these cute cuneiform tablets, handy-dandy cuneiform tablets. You've probably all seen pictures of them. They're little mud tablets. And the way they would write in them is they had a stylus, the stylus is shaped like this. The end makes an impression like this. And they would make these impressions and turn the stylus different ways, twirl it in their fingers and make different patterns. And each pattern of prints indicated a letter. And so they would write their letters this way probably. And so this would be all covered with these little jots. And oftentimes on the reverse side, it would also have all these little indentations. And then they would be able to read that because they can recognize these patterns. Now, how do you know what is on a tablet, a cuneiform tablet? Well, in Sumeria, typically down here, the last line, there'd be a half line right here. That would be reserved for the title of that tablet. It's like the title of a book, we put it on the spine. Well, this would be the title of that tablet right down there. There is some indication that in some parts of the ancient Near East, that appeared up here in the upper left-hand corner. So it has been argued, and I think quite plausibly, that what we have in these accounts, and this is called a colophon, that what we have in these intervals is the colophon saying the material coming up was from this source. These are the generations of, that is, these are the notes, these are the records from what follows. So as you see those, it's telling you the source of the material. And the argument continues, what we have in verse 1 is one of those colophons. It is the title of this first section. in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. If that's the case, then what we have is a summary statement right at the beginning. Verse 1, what is coming up is a story of the creation of the heavens and the earth. And I take the heavens and the earth to be a merism. It's giving you the extremes, which signifies the whole. That is, in the beginning, God created what is the universe, the cosmos. Now, how does that happen? What's going on here? At the beginning of the creative activity, the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit was moving over the surface of the waters. Now, I don't know whether what was actually the case is that there was water there and it was darkness, and God came and started to do his creative activity on that existing water or darkness. It seems to me that that's possible. But another possibility is that it's speaking poetically here of nothingness. That it's describing nothingness as that which is formless and void and darkness over the surface of the deep. The term formless and void is tohu vabohu, which by its very sound sounds kind of like we would do helter-skelter or something. It's just, there's no order. It's absolute chaos. And darkness was over the surface of the deep. It doesn't say darkness was over the surface of the sea. It doesn't say darkness was over the surface of the waters. It uses the term deep. And the term deep, both in Hebrew poetry as well as Canaanite poetry, indicates that which is absolutely antithetical to mankind. It is absolutely hostile to people, to human beings. So it seems reasonable to me that what's being described here is absolute nothingness, but what is distinctive about nothingness? The thing that's really distinctive about nothingness is there's no order. There's no order. Nothing can be seen. Nothing can be made out distinctly. Nothing can be perceived. And it's hostile to man. It's an inhumane place, a place that we cannot exist. So my inclination is to take this as a poetic description of nothingness. And that then is the situation when the creative activity begins. And in this last part of the verse, the Spirit of God was moving or hovering. The word is used as hovering, like a mother hawk over her nest, poised for action. So God is ready to move in and change this situation. And what follows then is a description of what he does, how he brings order and light and makes it hospitable to man instead of being the opposite. Now, we get into the really highly structured part of this section. If you'll notice, there are 7 days, six of those, the description is quite static. The description is repeated with each day, with some change. Each day begins with, "And God said." Each day has an imperative verb in it, "let there be this" or "let there be that." Most of the days and most of the activities conclude with, "and it was so," or "and it was good," or "God saw that it was good." And each day concludes with, "and there was evening and there was morning, day X." Since it is so highly structured, it draws attention to any deviations from that structure. The example I like to use for this is limericks. One time my wife accused me of being ignorant of poetry, and I argued that I was not ignorant of poetry. So she dared me to recite some, and I did, and she has never forgotten it. I recited one of my favorite poems, a love poem. There was a young man named Paul who went to a masquerade ball. He decided to risk it and go as a biscuit, but a dog ate him up in the hall. Isn't that special? Yeah. So, yes, well, what can I say? Yes, I convinced her. Limericks always have that pattern. They have that rhyme scheme, they have that rhyme, that same rhythm. So that allows us to do something with that scheme. Here's another limerick. There was a young man from Rome who delighted in writing a poem. But every darn time, the thing wouldn't rhyme, and he got so many words in the last line, it didn't make any sense anyway. The thing that makes the limerick work is the deviation from the pattern. The deviation from the pattern is the point. So anytime you have something that's highly structured like that, to deviate from the pattern draws attention to the deviation. So as we go through this, it seems to me that we ought to pay attention to any deviation from the pattern. And there are a couple of significant ones. Now, I don't know if I should do this, but I'm going to because it's in my notes. When I look at Genesis chapter 1, I can't help but be reminded of John chapter 1. Because there's some similar elements. In John chapter 1, I just want to read the first. In John chapter 1, it says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it." There are similar elements in that we have reference to Word, and that the Greek word there is logos. And we'll come back to that in just a second. There's reference to logos, and in the beginning of Hebrews, or of Genesis 1, each time there's creative activity, God speaks, which is a curious feature. Why does God speak at the beginning of each creative activity? It could be that all it's doing is drawing attention to God's power, because by the mere speaking of the word, it comes to be. That could be. If that's the case, then it's synonymous to saying, God snapped his fingers and it was so. Is there any further significance to the fact that he spoke? Another similarity is we have light shining in the darkness. In John 1, it's talking about the beginning, as in Genesis chapter 1, and it talks about light shining in the darkness, and that's what we have in the beginning of Genesis. Is there any relationship between those? I think there is. I have done some thinking about these first few verses of John 1, and I have come up with a different way of looking at it than has been taught to me in the past, and the way that I have looked at it in the past. And in fact, it differs from the way that Jack sees it. So I will just very briefly lay this out for you, for your perusal. The word logos here has a very broad range of meanings. If you look it up in the Big, Little, and Scott, which is the largest classical Greek lexicon, it takes up 3 full pages. There's just a wide range. It can mean word, it can mean speech, it can mean logic, logic comes from this word. Our word logic is derived from this word. It can mean rational. It can mean plan. There are a wide range of meanings. I think that what's going on here is that it means story or account. Life. I think what it means here is existence in conformity with God's principles. In other words, life the way it was intended, the way it ought to be lived. Light is understanding of that life. And darkness is the opposite of that, a lack of understanding. Okay, let me plug those meanings into those words in John 1. And I will read to you my greatly amplified translation of those verses as something for you to think about. You know, one thing that is really important to me and makes it possible for me to teach the Bible at all is I don't see my job as being the last word on any piece of any passage in Scripture. I see my job as just pointing some things out to you, indicating a way of thinking about it that is for you to consider. But I take very seriously the fact that it is your responsibility then to go away and reflect upon that and decide for yourself if it makes sense or if it does not make sense. I take that responsibility seriously, and I hope you will too. So let me read you what happens to John 1 if we plug these meanings into those words. From the beginning of time, God had a story in mind. And that story was about God. In fact, the story was exclusively about God. From the very beginning, the story was about God. Everything that happened contributed to this story. And not one thing happened that was superfluous to it. This story constitutes a portrayal of meaningful human existence and understanding of this, what meaningful human existence is what gives man fulfillment. And such understanding stands in stark contrast and even opposition to ignorance in this regard. But ignorance was unable to annihilate it. In other words, if I'm right, the prologue to John 1 is saying that, the prologue to the Gospel of John is saying that from the very beginning of time, God had this story that he wanted to tell. And this story that he wanted to tell was a story about who God is. And in that story, what would become clear is what life is. And that life, that understanding of what life is, would have an enlightening effect. It would make things clear. It would show things for what they are. It would dispel darkness. And in this story, the light could not be extinguished. The light, that is understanding of what life is all about, it persisted throughout this story. Then, he says, Jesus, the Word, the story, became flesh. In other words, that story worked itself out most particularly in one man, Jesus. He became the embodiment of this storyline. And what's important in the storyline being what life is all about. If that's true, if I'm anywhere near being right on that, John was not ignorant of Genesis chapter 1. I think John is building on Genesis chapter 1. And in fact, he may have gotten some of that content. If that's the content that's there, he may have drawn that from Genesis chapter 1. How could he possibly have got it from there? if we look back, this may make sense then of why every creative act begins with, "And God said, let something happen," instead of, "And God snapped his fingers." That this is a story that God is not, this is a story God is telling. This is not a universe that God is making as much as it's a story that God is telling. Creation is his self-expression. Creation is, instead of using words, he's using stuff to tell the story. And creation is that story. As we look through then to the structure of the 6 days, I will be skipping. I'll do this very quickly. The structure, I think, is if you look at it and think about the structure, and you don't think about chronology as necessarily the organizing principle, then I think the structure becomes pretty clear. In day one, what is made is light and dark. In day two, what is made is the waters are separated from the waters. In other words, we have the seas and the skies. In day three, we have the waters separated and dry land appears. That's in the first half of day three. The second half of day three, then vegetation is placed on the dry land. So in those first 3 days, we have what I think of as domains are created. Except for plants, let's put it this way, animate things are not made yet. That seems to be the division. Animate things are not yet made. What are made are places for animate things to be put into. Domains. And it starts from distant and it comes near. Each domain is closer to where we live, human beings live. Now, the next 3 days, it populates each of those areas in the same order. In day four, we have the luminous bodies are created. So we have animate things being placed in the first domain, the domain of light and dark. In day six, birds and fish are created. So we're populating the seas and the skies. That was day five. Day six, then, we have two parts. The first part of day six, animals are created on dry land. And in the second part of day six, man is created. Then day seven, which is presented to us differently than all of the other days. It doesn't say God does not do any creative activity. It does not say, then God said. It does not say, and there was evening, evening and morning, day whatever. It breaks the whole pattern, and that's the day of rest that God enters into. Okay, some observations on this structure. First of all, it moves from far to near with respect to man. So it's like this, I think of it as like a zoom camera. It is drawn way back to start with, and it zooms in. And what does it zoom in on? It's man. Everything moves in the direction of greater order, from lesser order to greater order. And that's obviously the emphasis in the way that the presentation is given. That God is organizing creation. He's putting things in its place. He puts boundaries on things. And that's good. And that the implication here is an important one, and that is to overstep those boundaries then is to return to chaos. Return to the way things were before God established order. Everything is declared good, or this declaration, and it was so, except for the last of the creative activities, and that is man. Now, there are other people that have commented on that particular feature. That's something that was noticed a long time ago. And there are people who would counter that and say, no, that's not exactly right, because it says, right after man is created, it says, where is that? That he looked at all that was made and it was all good.
31.
Yes. And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. So some people would say, well, that covered man as well. I'm inclined to think that that omission of it, and God saw that man was good, is very significant. I think what Moses means when it says, and God said it was good, is not that it was perfect in the sense that any alteration would make it worse, but rather it was the way he wanted it to be, good in that sense. Like if you're making something and you say, we'll call it good, that it's done, it's the way I want it. Well, we don't always mean it that way, do we? To call something, we'll call it good even though it isn't. But what he means is, it's the way I want it. But with man, that's omitted. And I think that that's a significant omission, in that the rest of Genesis goes on to talk about man, and the dominant theme is, man turned rebellious against God. There's something wrong with man. In fact, at one point in time, God killed all the men that he had created, except for 8. Because there was something wrong with man. So I think that what's being presented here is a focus on man as the pinnacle of creation. He's the last thing created. We zoom in on him. And yet, he's not quite right. There's work yet to be done. There's creative activity yet to be done with respect to man. And I think the rest of Genesis, as well as the rest of the Bible, then goes on to build on that particular theme.
Dave, I just see the lack of the statement of it was good in the context of the creation of man. Where is that omitted? This is the verse 31 encapsulate that.
Right. If all of the others, in every other case, everything that was created, it says, and it was good, or and it was so. Then we have, and God saw all that he had made and declared that it was good. So we have for everything else, we have a double good being proclaimed on it. Except for man. And it's that lack of a double good being proclaimed that I think is significant. So on every other thing, he's saying, it's the way that I want it. At the end, he's saying, and this whole setup is the way I want it. But he has omitted giving that special, yes, it's right, to man. Okay. Let me quickly conclude. I have skipped over a lot, and we can talk about those in questions if you want to. The picture that is emerging in my thinking of what God is doing, and I think that Genesis chapter 1 is setting this up, is that all of creation is and the history of this creation, what has happened since God made it, is all a grand story. And it is a grand story which is God's self-expression. He's telling this grand story. And what is the theme of this grand story? What's the purpose of this grand story? It is to tell us who God is. God wanted to make himself known. In doing so, he created a creature who plays a leading role in this story. And that creature is mankind. And man becomes this actor in this story through whom and to whom God can make this revelation. Man is both an actor and an audience to this story, who plays a leading role in it. And man is made then a creature in the midst of creation, and like everything else in creation, was made with given boundaries. He has a particular place in that creation. And it's everything staying in its place that provides the order that God wants to be there. Once that order is dissipated, it reverts to the chaos that was there before, which no one wants. Looking at some of the features of Egyptian religion, the thing that becomes abundantly clear is the Egyptians feared the natural forces deviating from their set pattern. The worst thing that could happen in life is for the flooding not to come at the right time in the right way. And all of their religion was focused on making sure that the gods kept chaos at bay, kept the order intact. And I think that captured something that is actually true, and that is the order in creation, in reality, is extremely important. It's a blessing and creation of God. And without that, there's no hope. Man is put into that order. He is made as a creature. True, he's made in the image of God. He occupies a very special place in that creation. He was made on the sixth day. He was the last of the creative activities. He was made in the image of God. So he plays a very special role in that creation. But nevertheless, he's a creature with certain boundaries on him. And as we'll see next week, that's very important. Man was created on the sixth day, but he's not quite done. He's not fully formed. There's work yet to be done. So then the rest of the Bible, and in fact the rest of history, is the playing out of this story. God telling us who he is, and telling us who he is by working in and through the lives of human beings as characters in this play. In the end, this God's story will be played out in full, just as planned, and God will be seen for who he really is. And that will be the end of history. When God has fully revealed himself, and a subplot that I don't think is hinted at in Genesis, but one that I think is nevertheless true, man will be fully shown for who he is. Okay, I want to let everyone go who needs to go, and then I will answer any questions that people might have.
You had mentioned the permanent is also saying which got resolved during the flood.
Oh, yes. I forgot to mention that. Yes. In day two, when the it says the waters were separated from the waters, and the firmament is formed. And the firmament apparently is the sky. That's what makes the most sense, where the clouds are. And the waters below are apparently the seas. There again, it does not say, and it was good. That's the other place where that is omitted. And I think that that's significant in that later on we have the flood. And the question is, how did that flood happen? What, meteorologically, what was that flood? And for several reasons, I'm inclined to think that there may have been when the waters were separated from the waters, there may have been some kind of canopy that was put in place. There are various canopy theories that was an ice canopy or a vapor canopy, but that something was put up in the firmament that then came down at the time of the flood. Now, when I first started looking at Genesis, I thought that was a little far-fetched, but one thing becomes really clear when you look at the flood, and that is life on earth, the way man experienced, the environment in which he lived, had to have been different after the flood from what it was before the flood. It was an environment-changing thing that happened. There's so many clues there, I don't see that that's avoidable. Therefore, it could very well be that when it does not say that the firmament was good, is an indication that there was a significant change yet to be made with respect to that, and that happens at the time of the flood. Right. Thanks. I failed to mention that. Tom?
Man created in God's image. I have a problem. I'm not sure. I mean, unresolved in my head, the lack of man being good, how does that equate, or what part of God's image then are we created like, or how have we given that much thought?
Well, there are two elements to my thinking. The first is, there's a clue in the text itself, and that is, after Cain killed Abel, Adam and Eve had another son, Seth. And it says with respect to Seth, he was in the likeness and image of Adam. Let me see if I can find that. Yes, chapter 5, verse 3. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image. Now, are we supposed to think Adam had red hair and so did Seth? I think not. Because in context, what it's just talked about is Cain and his descendants. And uniformly, they are wicked and rebellious. Then it switches and talks about the descendants of Adam through Seth. And nothing negative is said about them.
So it's character
rather than appearance that's being highlighted here. Which makes me think then that that's the significance of that expression with respect to man. Well, man doesn't have the character of God, so what would it mean? I think what it means is man is a moral being, as is God. That it's in that sense that man was made in the image of God. Now, if I bring in another line of thinking to that same question, I'm convinced that what we see in history is not only revelation of who God is, but also a revelation of who man is. And man has a dual nature. There are two aspects to what man is. One is, and this is what we see working itself out in history, and that is, man is an incredible creation, capable of doing a lot. And we can look, you look where you work and see and think about what man has become capable of doing. A computer is an outstanding example. The computer I've got on my table is more powerful than a computer that took up three floors of a building on campus when I was a freshman in college. It is incredible what man has done. Man has cloned a sheep.
I think we found a way to stop aging. Just heard that earlier.
Not much time, is there? but when you think about it, it is phenomenal what mankind has been able to achieve. So there's that one aspect of man, that is his capability. The other aspect of, and that in history is becoming clearer and clearer. The other aspect of man is the wickedness and the rebelliousness that he's capable of. And both of those themes with respect to man are being developed.
How about the possibility of the knowledge of good and evil? Or or being created with the understanding of, let's say, the golden rule. Mm-hmm. Could that be part of that image, or is that what you mean by the morality?
We are moral beings. That is, by nature, we struggle with what is morally right and wrong. Whether wicked or good, everyone struggles with that. That we can't help but be sensitive to that issue. It's built into us. I think that's what it means when it says that we were made in the likeness of God, the image of God.
Sanity, is that not determined by whether you know right from wrong?
Sanity? Used to be.
Used to be?
Yeah.
They got this guy up there now, the letter bomber.
Yeah.
Put him to play the psychologist and see if he's sane. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
A couple of questions. One is, I'd like to hear your comments on the seventh day. Mm-hmm. That idea. Mm-hmm. The other thing too is, on the one hand, it seems to me that we can take the idea of God creating something and calling it good. One way to take that, particularly when we come to man, and he doesn't say that, is because God isn't calling man good at that point, and therefore saying, in effect, something like, man isn't yet what I want him to be. We could say that's very early, that's the earliest clue that we have that there's something morally wrong with man, there's something about man's character that's not yet right. But it also seems to me that one way to look at it might be that with regard to this idea of God telling a story, that when God creates something and calls it good, it's in a sense saying, like, God has created this, and although this thing will continue to exist throughout this history of creation, there isn't a lot more to be said about it as far as God's concerned. It's done, it's there, it's existing. Mm-hmm. An animal is an animal, and mm-hmm. that's that.
Mm-hmm. I'm not following that thread of the story any further.
Right, right. You know, there may be, like from our point of view, there's a lot to be said about creation, our discovery of it, but from God's perspective, it's for his purposes, creation is essentially finished in that respect, but the story of man is not yet done.
Right.
So in that sense, this may not necessarily be right. have anything to do with the moral standing of God, of man, as much as it's just saying, at this point, I'm beginning my story, but I'm working and I'm writing this story still. This right. line.
I think that's possible. Right. I think that's possible. It just so happens that the story that he goes on to tell deals with the need for the moral transformation of man.
Yeah, and I guess with that in mind too, is just what is your take on the seventh day?
Yeah.
And where it does say here too. I mean, I know it doesn't say that God created anything and called it good, but it does say, and by the seventh day, God completed his work, which he had done, kind of implying either by the seventh day or somehow at the seventh day, God has now put a period at the end of that sentence, or of the last sentence of that story.
Right. I don't know how helpful I can be on the seventh day, but I think that what we have in the creation narrative is a summary of the story that the rest of the Bible goes on to tell. And that the seventh day is an indication that at the end of this story, God's creative activity ends. He enters into this rest, and this rest does not have an evening in a morning, day seven, that it goes on, it's endless.
The idea being that our often our concept of referring to God, you know, God rested on the seventh day, a past term kind of concept of it is really wrong, but that the seventh day is actually still coming.
Yeah. That's the way I think that it's intended. That what we have is this, we have one chapter telling us what the story of all creation is. And day seven is intended to be telling us what the ending of the story is. We've got this whole story here right in front of us in one chapter. Then the rest of the Bible and history goes on to fill out the details of that story. But the plot line's right there.
Because in up through chapter 2, verse 2, or verse 3, it talks all the way about all the way through day 1 through day 7. But at verse 4, it jumps back into day 6. And when you read the rest of the Bible to the very end, you have yet to reach that day 7, although there's a lot of hints of this coming age, this kingdom of God, you know, that they talk about. So.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah, I think that's right. So we're still in day 6 in that sense. Waiting for the calendar. We want to flip the calendar, right?
With regard to Adam and Eve, if you're going to answer this next week, but with regards to them maybe already being not good, then how does he use the Adam and Eve story, or how does that fit in? Is that just, I mean, how do you make that fit in? If you're going to go into that next week, you don't have to answer that.
How do I fit that into what?
Well, the question is if man's not really good or complete, mm-hmm. why does he have to go into the Adam and Eve story? Or is that just eating the apple, or taking from the fruit?
What is his fault? If they're already...
Yeah, I mean, if they're not really fall, or if they're not really going to fall after the fruit, or does he go backwards and tell... Is it because it's not chronological at that time?
The story of Adam and Eve is telling us the nature of man's flaw. So man is created, and then the first thing we have told about man after he's created is a story that makes clear what is man's flaw, what's his problem. So I think it's probably the case that man was made, in a sense, flawed. And the story of Adam and Eve is making clear what that flaw is. What is the nature of that defect? What is the nature of this human being that God made?
In that he's rebellious.
Right. It's exactly, he wants to jump the boundaries that God has placed on him. He wants to go to chaos.
See, you get the impression, at least I got the impression growing up, and, you know, talking to people, is that we're judged by God for the flaw. But if you, taking the whole history of, the whole Bible as a whole, kind of taking the Bible as a whole, you get the idea that it's not really judgment for the flaw. It's judgment for how you respond to having that flaw. I mean, do you respond to it with... do you acknowledge the flaw and do you seek mercy for the flaw, or do you rationalize the flaw? You see my point? Is that... So a lot of people would have a problem with the idea that Adam was created with a flaw, because what they want to see is the reason why we all got in this mess is some dude back in the first century made a mistake, and we're all living with that. But what you would be saying is that God actually created this flaw. Heaven and hell is populated not by people who have that flaw, but by people who either choose to ignore it or deal with it way that he improves
him.
Do you see it that way? Or?
Yeah. He created man with a propensity to be rebellious. And we all end up, in fact, acting in rebellion. We all I just was talking about this with my kids. We're all a little bit perturbed that we were not made gods. It's a little disconcerting to us that we were not made gods. And that's the nature of mankind. And that's the very flaw that the serpent exploits. What we're judged for is that rebellion. But God is making available to us forgiveness for repenting of that rebellion.
I think that part of the one of the things inherent in God creating something and calling it good is that there's something about that thing He's created that is content to be defined by the boundaries that He's set around it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's what. Right. Ultimately, what He requires of us is that we fit into the order that we as creatures were placed here to occupy, just like everything else in creation. That's what He requires of the seas and of the dry land and of everything else, that they occupy the place that was assigned to them. And the thing that's unique about man is he chafes at those boundaries that were put around him. That's the nature of his rebellion.
Back to talking about the fall of man. Does the Bible actually use that terminology?
The fall of man?
Mm-hmm. Or is that something that we have labeled in Genesis?
I don't know.
Because I don't see it anywhere in the first 3-4 chapters.
I've heard the term the fall, it's not part of the Bible.
Yeah.
That was added in. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, it could very well be. I don't recall it from Scripture. I've never thought about that or never looked at it, but that could very well be. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't object to the term, though, either, because in the sense that it's not that something new showed up in Genesis 3, wholly unanticipated. But it is the first time that it's manifest, that we see it. Something that I don't think Adam and Eve even dreamed that they were capable of rebelliousness against God prior to that. They probably hadn't turned on it, hadn't thought about it.
At least to me it seems like it indicates that they're pretty surprised.
Mm-hmm.
But the rules were there.
Yeah, but we'll see when we go back and look at it. It's human minds work in strange ways, and we do lots of things with rules. Some of them good and some of them bad. And we'll look at it next week. We can think about that more. Yes.
Can I get in there? Why I'm asking this question, but it seems like a strange question, but I'm wondering if you could, in light of what you just said, comment on Cain's sin. I think what I'm wondering about is if man's major temptations to rebel against the confines and the boundaries and the limitations that God puts on us. Why did Cain kill Abel?
As opposed to what?
That's kind of my question. We have lots of options.
Right, right.
Why did he kill Abel?
Right, right. I think that's the first sign that we have that one of the effects of rebelliousness is insanity. I'm using it strongly. But
you guess the insanity?
Yeah.
I mean, what was he getting rid of apart from his brother?
Right. It makes no sense. See, what he was doing, he was mad. It was an all-consuming anger and sense of injustice. Because Abel's sacrifice offerings were being accepted and his were not. And you can imagine him. It's not hard to put yourself in his place. He just focuses on the injustice of it and acts rather impetuously, not rationally, but impetuously. Just thinks, well, but it's his fault. He somehow is the cause of my pain.
Rather than my fault,
God's right.
Fault.
Right.
I mean, it's
right.
Crazy that he
right.
Himself and
right.
He's also curious to me that
right. And I think that's why it's there, that the nature of the rebelliousness in man is not just white lies. It is full-blown wickedness right from the start. But let me, the thing about his act was irrational. That's important. I think it's important to notice that it is the nature of rebelliousness to cloud our vision as to what makes sense and what does not make sense. And the example that, whenever I talk about this, the first example that comes to mind is when I was in Rome about 20 years ago. I was reading in a magazine, an Italian magazine, about the Marxists in northern Italy. And they were carrying out a campaign of shooting the kneecaps of workers as they came out of the factory. Now you'd say, well, why would Marxists, was he Marxist? They side with the workers, and they're shooting the kneecaps of workers. Where is the logic here? And the logic was this. They were frustrated at any attempts of riling up the workers against the factory owners. And they had tried agitation, they tried explaining this to the workers, and it was just apathy. They couldn't get any action. And they tried to terrorize the factory owners, and that wasn't working. So what they reasoned is, we just need something to make them stop being apathetic. So they start shooting their kneecaps. Well, there's a twisted logic there that is not foreign to human beings. That with rebelliousness comes this propensity to twisted logic that has, we blame things on other people, that when you stand back and look at it objectively, the blame doesn't go there, but we're capable of putting it there. Finding the problem where it ain't, we do that all the time. So there's a cloudiness that rebellion causes. We lose clarity on what's going on, what's making it happen, what's cause, what's effect. All of that becomes murky. And I think that's what we're seeing in society as a whole. You know, what causes poverty? What causes crime? Those are all questions in which society has become really foggy-headed on it. And as a result, we pursue solutions that are non-solutions.
One of the things I thought was interesting a while back was listening to the news, and that actually I thought was kind of a hopeful sign, was that there's a growing kind of debate and kind of movement towards taking a look at the two options in the legal system that says either you're guilty or you're not guilty by reason of insanity. And to pick a middle road, one that says insane and guilty. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you know, you think of someone like let's say Timothy McVeigh or someone like that, it may have been possible to show, well, the only reason someone would ever do something like that would be, right, he's insane, he could have put that forward, they could have made the case, and he could have gotten off. And people are kind of going, well, what do you do with that? I mean, if someone goes, just fumes over with anger at their kids and abuses them, they get punished for child abuse. And what, you know, I mean, they, what's dealt with there is like, well, the problem is that your anger is out of control. Mm-hmm. You're guilty of this, and you need to change. Mm-hmm. You know, but a lot of people are getting away with murder. Mm-hmm. You know, with the, just because they're insane, and this modern idea of kind of being clinically insane, therefore you can't be seen guilty of doing anything wrong, mm-hmm. right? And I just thought it was kind of a hopeful thing that some people are beginning to look at that and say, mm-hmm. maybe those two options aren't giving us the full breadth of what the law can do.
It is our tendency in our society to see crime as a disease. And the more we see crime as a disease, the more inhumane punishments become. The more inhumane our dealings with those people can become. That's what we see everywhere. Yes?
I'm curious about the language in verse 26 of 1, and I think it does it again in chapter 3 about God said, let us.
Yes.
And our.
Yes.
What is that? Do you have any perspective on what that
means? Yes.
Or why that language is being used?
Mm-hmm. There are several possible explanations for that. The most common one is that that is a sign of the triune nature of God, and therefore the plural is used. Another possibility is there is in Semitic languages what is called the royal we, where a king will say, we decree that from now on people won't park out here after 3 o'clock. And what the king means by that is, I decree, but the we is used. It's kind of like the editorial we. So that's another possibility. My inclination, though, is to go with the third possibility, and that is what is sometimes called the deliberative plural. And there is precedence for this being used in Semitic languages. We use it, but not terribly frequently. I have caught myself using it a couple of times. If I'm working in the shop all by myself, I will sometimes think to myself, let's see, what will we do next? It's that feature, though, that's called the deliberative plural, and I suspect that that's what we have here. Yeah, God's talking to himself.
And from an apologetic standpoint, then that actually weakens the fact that there are other possibilities, weakens the argument that of the Trinity, for example.
Well, yeah, I think this is not great evidence for the Trinity,
yeah.
If that's what you mean. Yeah.